Okay, so I didn't see fucking Blue Beetle, and Chris said right before we started, "What's a Blue Beetle?" So there's a good chance he hasn't seen it. Yeah, okay, so I gotta say, I haven't paid attention to any of that stuff, and I'm really enjoying lately not. I'm almost done with all the comic book movies and TV shows. I don't hate them by any means, but I was just thinking that, like, they've almost enriched my life. Not at all. They're good, some of them, but just not a... Not, I think we were just saying that, like, with the Marvel Universe, the Marvel movies, it's like, you know what you're going to get? It's just going to be a pretty, not bad. Like, I was saying, it's a B-.
Yeah, it's like watching Law and Order for me at this point. It's like, well, you'll be entertained.
Right, yeah. Can't complain too much, but also, like, you know, I've only got so many heartbeats left in this world. You know, that being said, I still watch it, you know? I just can't get a boner about it. But Wendell, you got a blue boner. Okay, that's can't be the right way to say that. You saw Blue Beetle. What did you think? I mean,
It was great. I had a lot of fun with it. I don't know. I don't know if you guys watch Cobra Kai, but the kid playing Jaime is like one of the main stars from Cobra Kai.
Yeah.
And I don't know. His acting is pretty sloppy, I think, because he's a young kid and this is like his first big shot or whatever, but it's also like really raw. I don't know much about Jaime Reyes or the Blue Beetle mythos, really. I've read some Blue Beetle Booster Gold team up comics back in the like Cord days, but I think it does a good job of like filling in those gaps for you while also making a gigantic effort to put a spotlight on the Hispanic community in every way.
That's good.
It is. Yeah. My wife was almost like, she was like, a lot of Spanish in that.
Yeah,
and I was
your Mexican
like,
wife,
I was like, yeah,
by the way.
My Mexican wife. Okay. My Mexican wife.
You might
want to
qualify.
Like,
my wife, racist, was like, ugh,
yeah,
there's a lot of Mexicans.
My wife, Michelle Smith, was like,
she is Michelle Smith now.
She is Michelle Smith now. No, yeah, but it was really fun. It was really high energy. The fight scenes were really cool. I feel like it definitely it had like mad Shazam energy, like Shazam 1 energy. Just real fun. Like stakes kind of low. The bad guy is rich white women,
right?
And everybody can get on board with that.
Yeah, definitely.
Like, nobody's mad at that.
You know what? You know what I think it is. Where I'm at with all this fucking I don't know. Comic book movies and larger culture. I think where it all lost me in terms of investment was when comic book stuff really hit the mainstream. And it sounds like that's a cynical, like, it's popular now kind of take, but that's not how it was with me for a while. Like, I was excited as any kid who grew up with these characters to finally see them in, you know, live action and kind of have the movie in front of me that was always playing my head. But what it's wrought, I think just... so it's the difference between those cultures being like, you know, when we were kids, these sort of very nerdy, very nobody knows about this but me, and almost this excitement of like, nobody knows these stories are really good but me kind of thing. And, you know, you would meet fellow travelers at comic stores who are equally borderline autistic or stunted in their development, but really passionate about it. And now what it is, and it's probably not completely the movies, it's probably also social media, but like the fucking blah culture that this has been part of. I fucking hate comic book Twitter and anything like it. Stan culture is toxic, disgusting, uncreative. I'm sorry for the listener. I'm sorry if you consider yourself one of these people. Like, I guess I am too. I'm sorry, but it's just I find it totally unappealing, unartistic, like unuseful. It's just blech.
I mean, I will say that you have. I understand that opinion from a person who has been like taking on the Sisyphean task of arguing with just the worst people.
I'm like Martin
on behalf
Sheen.
Of our Twitter account.
I'm like Martin Sheen in Apocalypse Now. Like, I don't know. I've seen the horror, but anyway, so
just
I got
burnout staring at your ceiling fan.
Yeah, so I'm almost just ready to make the decision. Like, I might see these movies when they come out or think about them wild hair up my ass kind of stuff. But I think I'm kind of just sticking to the comics now. And if that's a cunty purist thing, I'll just put ground it in, like, I just enjoy it so much more than the opposite. So.
Yeah, I mean, a big reason we went to go see Blue Beetle is I think I will just have the standing decision that I will go see DC movies that are even mildly appealing mm-hmm. to me just to put some money in the bank because they need it. And, you know, it's like, you know, your friend that's down on his luck, you're making sure he's got cab fare. Like, that's, I'm at least going to give them some honest metrics.
Right, they deserve it. Yeah, I'm with you. And I will say, just before we get into the episode, there is a bit too much of an exaggeration with how bad DC movies are and how good Marvel movies are. Like, I think, you know, Chris sort of nailed this up top. I'm just discursive to, like, your more, I don't know, direct point, which is that, like, there's just the Marvel stuff is always okay. It's always a bit good. It's sort of very competent studio stuff, but completely uninspiring. And then the DC stuff is, when it's, at least it's amazingly bad when it's bad. It's just absurdly stupid. Just trash.
Yeah, you know? With the Marvel Universe, it's all a focus group, and, like, they have a very elaborate plan, I understand. It's, like, very planned out, and studio, like, it's the studio system has resurrected itself with the Marvel stuff. And the DC thing, it seems like they just, if an interesting director or an interesting script comes along, they'll give it a try, and sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. But, I mean, the Batman movies by Nolan are great, and even, you know, the one with Michael Keaton and Jack Nicholson. But, you know, also you get, you guys watched the Green Lantern ones. You told me it was horrible. I haven't seen it, but I'll take your word for it. But,
right,
yeah, the Marvel movies are just kind of, you know, vanilla soft serve. I mean, they're pretty good, but, you know, you're not going to get any surprises.
Yeah, the MCU is like, they would never let that happen because they would never let anything interesting happen. And, you know what I mean? And really bad. I mean, that's a fantastic exaggeration, but, I mean, anyway. Okay, you guys, rather than the crappy movies, how about a great comic that we'll talk about? You guys ready?
Infinity and Beyond.
Yeah. Welcome to the Comic Canon Revival, a podcast where we look at some of the most beloved stories in the history of comics, both new and old. We take exemplary, historic, and even bizarre stories, and we put them under our figurative microscope. Let's do that now. Man, here is an episode I knew we would always get to. I was very excited to do this. I just think it's one of, I don't know, it's one of my favorite comics for sure. This is a me pick, I guess. But it's also, again, in kind of the top 25 major comic events that ever happened. So, of course, our podcast was going to cover it. We're doing the Infinity Gauntlet, but my choice was to say, let's do Thanos Quest as well. I would sort of argue Thanos Quest is really act one of the story.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, like, if we had just jumped in at the beginning of Infinity Gauntlet, I would have been very disappointed. Like, as to, sure. Like, I would have had to have tracked back, just because I've actually, this is my first time reading this, so nice. I was very excited to just see the differences. I was like, okay, I'm going to pick apart the differences between this and the MCU version. And I gave up on that immediately because it's all differences. There's literally almost zero. It's easier to find the small link connections and references than it is to really try and piece this together the MCU way.
Yeah, the MCU sort of Infinity War and then Endgame, those sort of two things, they take inspiration for this. They're by no means an adaptation. You know, Marvel was sort of trying the MCU was trying to make a sort of cap to its big, experiment with an expanded sort of cinematic universe. And they kind of used the MacGuffins of the Infinity Gauntlet, sort of Infinity Gems, and then had, you know, Thanos as their big bad. But beyond that and some other, you know, references here and there, it's not an approximation of the story. It doesn't try to be. And I agree, there's a certain freedom of not having to be like, well, they did it different in this part and versus the whole thing is really different. But I will say, you said this is the first time you read this. I would say most people, you know, since the story came out after that, most people are just reading Infinity Gauntlet because you're like anybody else. You want to know what the fuss was about and you just pick up that trade and you read it and it's good. It functions totally well without the beginning story. But I think that there is, again, if we were just thinking cinematically, if we were going to sort of do a direct adaptation, maybe like an animated feature, they would definitely put the Thanos Quest sort of part in there because it's basically the building up of the villain, you know?
And it also helps lend perspective to the type of character Thanos is before and after the like absolute power, which is really important to like the dynamic of this narrative, which is for you to like understand how corrupt this power can really, or how corrupting this power can really be to a person who is like one of the only creatures that can even handle trying to do it. And it's and Thanos Quest, I would like love just that to have been its own movie. And like, I get the whole tying it in and it was all handled, but that would have just been so awesome to have just to watch Thanos go and just trick six old motherfuckers out of their rocks.
I'd also argue, by the way, that not just sort of getting to see the before and after, but also we get, I think, some of the most interesting and sort of full, like sort of fulsome characterization of Thanos in that as well, just in sense of what he's like and who he is. By the way, I got way ahead of myself. Welcome, listener. You know, it's us again. I just want to introduce you on the show for the listener, especially if you don't listen all the time. I'm Jared McCorkle. With me, as always, the Pip the troll to my Adam Warlock, Wendell Smith is here. Hello, Wendell.
Okay, yeah. That one came out of left field, and I love it.
Yeah.
Love it. Yeah.
And then
Pip the Troll is what's up.
Yeah, he's great. Patton Oswalt is also going to be doing the voice of Wendell Smith. So that's exciting. Look forward to that from now on. And then Chris Blaker is here.
Hello, everybody.
Welcome back. Again. Yay. Let's finish that housekeeping before we get too much into the details until everybody's raring to go. Like I said, we're doing Thanos Quest and Infinity Gauntlet. Thanos Quest came out July to August 1990, and quickly following that up, Infinity Gauntlet, May to December of 1991. So early 90s, I feel this is like timeless and ahead of its time, but we'll get more into that later. The writers for Thanos Quest... The creative team for Thanos Quest was Jim Starlin as the writer. The penciler was Ron Lim. Inker, John Betty. Colorist, Tom Vincent. Letters were Ken Branzenak. Editors were Craig Anderson and Renee Witterstatter. What a fucking hell of a name there, Witterstatter. A German nightmare. Anyway, and then for Infinity Gauntlet specifically, the creative team... Writer was Jim Starlin, pencilers George Perez and Ron Lim, inkers Joe Rubenstein with Tom Christopher and Bruce Solotoff, colorists were Max Scheel, Ian Laughlin, and Evelyn Stein, the letterer was Jack Morelli, and the editors were Craig Anderson, and that's it for that one. Anyway, okay, so that's our creative team. Also, just look it up, but, you know, it just feels right to say this and that. Like I said, this was a me pick, and it was I just picked it because this is one of my favorite crossovers of all time, and not just a personal favorite. I don't think they get a lot better than this. There's so many good things about this. I think it's incredibly well focused, and it feels expansive, even to the degree. And I think this is something that Cosmic Comics usually lack. It has a kind of Lovecraftian feel, not in the Cthulhu stuff. But in the kind of metaphysics, meaning that like the world is bigger than the Earth. It's sort of like the universe exists irrespective of us. And I really love that about this. It feels like our point of view, the sort of Earth heroes, are just barely bearing witness and sort of on the periphery of the main events in many ways. So I think that's really cool and gives it a cosmic feel. Wendell, do you want to do a back of the postage stamp description of the story?
Yeah, sure. With both of them combined. So Thanos Quest in the Infinity Gauntlet is a story about a purple space alien with extreme power and might bestowed upon him by the Avatar of Death in the Marvel Universe, sets out to collect these stones that give him an unlimited power of a god. And he successfully does so and then goes mad with that power and kills half the universe. And the remaining heroes left respond and try to stop him and bring them back.
Yeah.
That's as good as we're going to get. I think that's great. Yep, that's exactly
or
what
even
happened.
Shorter basically. Is Thanos, she's just not that into you.
Yeah. Purple alien simps.
Yeah.
Death till everyone's dead.
It's definitely true. Well, let me ask you first. I mean, so I have a deep affection for the story. Wendell, you seem to like it. Chris, what was your sense of it? Just sort of first blush. Did you end up liking it? Where were you?
I really enjoyed it. For me, I liked the art slightly better in Thanos Quest. Like the backgrounds of the cosmos are just amazing. And I enjoyed the Infinity Gauntlet, the 6-part thing. I knew not how it ended, but you know that Nebula takes the gauntlet from him as she's like half dead, half alive. Because I'd read this article in Wizard years ago about 50 greatest crossovers, and it kind of spoiled it for me, but and I've not seen the Marvel movies, but yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was a great tight story, and it was like a big therapy session for Thanos. He had to like go through all this stuff and you know, realize he really didn't want to be king of everything.
Yeah, let's talk about Thanos a little bit. I mean, this is his story unequivocally. That's interesting unto itself. This is Marvel's sort of second big crossover post. It was only after Secret Wars. This was not an seasonal occurrence like it is now. So it's sort of like, I shouldn't say they were taking such a huge risk, I think, and I'll explain why. But generally speaking, this was sort of like a first, or this was still a novel sort of thing to do. And it's interesting that this isn't like just a big Avenger story. This is Thanos's story. I find that sort of bizarre, and people have talked about the Infinity War and Endgame, how in many ways it's Josh Brolin's Thanos story. It's like, that's nothing compared to this. You know, all the other characters sort of barely kind of scratch you get it. They're barely protagonists or whatever. But yeah, so I wanted to mention something, because you mentioned about that Lady Smith, Black Mumbazu. That Lady Death empowered Thanos. Just to give you a sense, Thanos has his own sort of unique sort of sediments of power. So Thanos is one of the Eternals, or he is at least of that lineage, like from the movie. Just think of Icarus with basically a Superman-y kind of character, right? Then he is a deviant version of the Eternals, which is sort of like their mutant kind of thing. It's a bit convoluted the way they've explained that, but just know the idea, like he almost is a mutated version that's even more powerful.
At this point in the story, that's established?
Yes, absolutely. So, but I just want to give you a sense of before. Sorry. Yeah, no problem. So I'm saying from birth, he is an Eternal, and they have a certain level of kind of like Superman level cosmic ish like low deity power. Then he's a mutant kind of advancement of that, where his all of the cells in his body absorb cosmic energy. That's just what they do. So he's just sort of already really powerful, and then he augments himself mechanically and through magic to become even more powerful, and then in the service of death, and after over several stories, he dies, and he's brought back by Lady Death to be even more powerful. So that's what we have at the beginning of the story. I say this because, like, I think a lot of people who, especially if you only read Infinity Gauntlet number one, you wouldn't have a sense that he's already got sort of, like, he's already well-established as a sort of dark side-level character, even before we get into this crazy cosmic stuff.
Yeah, okay, so, and what I meant was all of that was established by this point. Because, I know that there's been a lot of story building on Thanos's, like, origins and stuff since then. So I just didn't know, like, what was already established. But, like, that is a wild, I mean, It's fairly clear that like he came into it already packing or whatever, mm-hmm. but just the way he kind of like undersells or like never undersells. He like clearly explains how powerful he is to every person he meets all the time. You know, he's like, I just don't understand if you know that like also death gave me some shit and you should just give me that rock.
I think kind of, but I think what's interesting about most of this story until well into the kind of issue 4 of Infinity Gauntlet where he's fighting Earth heroes, actually Thanos is kind of fighting people well above his pay grade. So it's not he's just big dicking everybody. As a matter of fact, like when you would watch the movie, you know, there is that sense where it's like, oh, this is some big cosmic baddie. The first people that Thanos is going to take on in the story as we're reading it in Thanos Quest are the Elders of the Universe. Up to this point in comics, outside of like the great abstract cosmic beings, the Elders are big bads all each to their own. You wouldn't have necessarily a sense of that from just reading this. But so the Collector or Games Master, each were like far above all the combined Avengers in their sort of inaugural stories and things like that. But I should also say, to give you another sense of Thanos, and we'll discuss him more just in terms of the character we have in the story, but just in terms of like kind of the brief history, he had been around for a while. There had been several stories. A lot of it was in, you know, Captain Marvel comics, some Avengers comics or what have you, as this sort of character, as described before, this lover of death. Jim Starlin kind of openly ripped him off of, I think as he put it, like a combination of Darkseid and Metron. He wanted the kind of enigmatic intelligence of Metron with the kind of beefier, granite strength, cosmic death god of Darkseid or whatever. But he's done versions of this several times, usually I think written at a like proto level, not as interesting, not as layered as the story we're going to get. Like he got the cosmic cube before, and then he got a bunch of soul gems before without knowing they were infinity gems and things like that. So this is in some sense like when you're reading now a more refined, like more a doomsday evolution, if you will, to cross-pollinate comic metaphors of that, those sorts of Thanos gets powerful thing, tries to conquer the world story.
Yeah, this story is written like a like Greek myth, like it, or like a very like classic.
Yes.
Like it reminds me of just like, you know, just the way Hercules is just like has to sometimes think his way out as opposed to fight his way out or whatever.
Right.
Like and like knows his opponent, like, because that's really like that's really this what is awesome about Thanos Quest is that like each encounter, Thanos knew exactly what they were going to do and how he was going to respond. Like, at no point was he ever actually not in control of the situation. I mean, even still, if he wasn't, like, flexing on them, like, he was so confident in himself that it's so fun to read.
Right.
Because you're right, and, like, I understand that these are these Eternals or these
Elders of the Universe.
Elders that he goes, yeah. They are not really shown to be that threatening, but like are very clearly explained to be so. So like, I think that just does it. That just lends itself to the way it's written that like at no point was Thanos, brute strengthening it. He just knew who he was fighting, how he needed to fight them. And it was really, really fun. And you said timeless, and that's exactly the word for it.
With them, I'll say also, just to give you a sense, the Elders of the Universe are, the lore is even more vague as to why they are what they are. The idea is that they are each from extinct races that began in the beginning of the universe. And they've at some point learned to be like it. This is the mechanics are never completely explained. It's just something about them being those from those first sort of sentient races in the beginning of the cosmos. They are somehow immortal. And we're each sort of obsessed with a particular goal or fascination or fucking hobby or fetish, you know, and just lived on to eternity. And then later on, we have some stories that precede this just in the sort of just preceding run, the story that this comic actually grows out of, where they became rejected by death and actually technically can't die. I just mentioned all this that like outside of knowing they're very powerful, the reason they have this sort of nigh cosmic ability is actually kind of vague and ill explained, especially at the level of this story. But yeah, like I sort of wanted to piggyback on something you said, which is that it is interesting that, you know, Thanos is very low stack in the beginning. Everyone he's fighting is sort of far above him, or at least initially, and he's sort of, they underestimate his intelligence, and they underestimate his ambition and what he knows, his insight. And then he achieves godhood, and then kind of, you know, underestimates the things beneath his notice, and it kind of ends up being his undoing. But I also wanted to say, to your point, you said it's like a Greek story. I mean, it's very, it definitely has a Greek tragedy element to it. There's, I think there's, as you know, like, especially with his relationship to death. But also, I felt Shakespearean drama a little bit here. I think that some, we get some really good Thanosian soliloquy or whatever. There's some really wonderful yeah. moments of where, damn you, woman, what does it take to please you? yeah, really good stuff.
These elders are not, well, I was not impressed. I guess it's that they're so complacent because they think they're so powerful. But yeah, this... Thanos just like stole all their gems. It seemed, well, the way the story was presented, back to back to back, without a lot of trouble. Yeah, I mean, they're supposed to be powerful, but yeah. they're not that bright, I guess.
Yeah, I think it's that what you said, like that they're apathetic or they've become like kind of like slothful or something like that, very complacent. I think that's really what we're meant to think, is that they've just had, you know, and in the history of comics. Like, you know, these characters weren't necessarily all introduced at once. You know, there was the Collector was first, and then the Games Master, and then the Champion, and they've each sort of appeared in different places. Champion famously got all the Earth heroes together and had them do a boxing match or whatever to prove how great he was. But they have a tendency to very, like, look down beneath the normal Marvel heroes and characters and stuff like that. So, you can see them as sort of, like, you know, godlike beings or more who aren't used to being challenged. And so when Thanos comes to call on them, they're really ill prepared for his, again, you know, savvy, you know, canny nature.
Can I ask you guys a question about the movie before we go on? So,
sure.
In the movies, does the Collector appear, and is he played by Benicio del Toro?
Yeah, he's, yes. I would say, sadly, the Elders of the Universe are among the most, like, they're the most underused, because they're incredibly powerful, and they really could have been their own interesting force, and that pretty much got squandered, which is hilarious because it's an 11 fucking movie film. You know, especially
Jeff Goldblum plays
Games Master.
Okay, I might watch that. Okay, that part.
I think those are the only two they show. That,
he's good. Yeah, he's good in Ragnarok. In Thor Ragnarok, where he appears.
Oh, that's who he is.
And where he's a kind of side
villain.
Yeah,
no, that was a lot of fun. I enjoyed that one, and I enjoyed his role in it.
But he does very little in terms of the broader story, which is too bad because, I mean, he's a great actor, and maybe they just couldn't get him for more than that. But the Collector really gets sort of, like, I mean, he's farcically underused, I thought. I mean,
yeah. You know. They did a What If episode on Disney Plus that I feel like sells that, like, it really illustrates his power a lot better. And I think also they probably just had Benicio del Toro on the hook for one more.
Right.
One more, like, VA voice actor run or something.
But it looked like Benicio del Toro really, like, played that character up. I thought he was perfectly, you know, eccentric and chewing the scenery. And yeah, it's sort of unfortunate. Also, if this comic doesn't really tell you how powerful the Elders of the Universe are, that the movies don't, you would have no idea they have superpowers whatsoever. You know, they're just guys that are weird and you know, pulling strings or something like that. But yeah, so a little bit more on Thanos outside of just like the basic lore, the details. I think what's interesting about Thanos is. And what I love about, especially Thanos' Quest, and why I wanted us to read it too, is that he's a very, I think, surprisingly subtle character. He is not a sadist, as I think, at least not in this story. Like, he's, you know, it's a broad comic history. Sometimes he's depicted as far more cruel and things like that. He's hardly a good guy here, but I think that there are scenes that are, again, not even redemptive, just that suggest, like, he really is motivated by being in love with death and wanting to sort of like be for her and achieve her goals or what have you, and not with just like torturing insects or something like that. So I think that's impressive. I also think it's impressive that he's there's an irony to him, which is that he is this massively powerful, beating the shit out of the Hulk level character at some level. But again, his primary, threat is his intelligence, is that he seems to understand the world. He's 12 steps ahead of everybody else. I didn't mean it like in an alcoholic, like he's finally sober. But also he, he's that many steps ahead of everybody, but that he kind of understands the nature of the cosmos maybe better than everyone around him. I think he's threatening.
My name is Thanos, and I've been addicted to power for 12 years now.
You don't even want power, man. You're just trying to deal with what your uncle did to you. That's what this whole thing is.
I love when he is talking to Nebula after she took the gauntlet from him. Like, she's still she's still beneath him or right. whatever. Just like, you don't even know how to fucking use that thing.
And, he's a dick, for sure.
He's a dick, but he's also not wrong. Like he literally, everything he's saying is, a legit fact. It just happens to make him sound like the, it just happens to also talk him up. And I loved it also, when you had said it was Lovecraftian, because of Thanos being sort of the driving force, they don't actually take, there's no point where I feel like I'm being talked down to about what's happening. Because we're looking at it through Thanos' eyes, everything that changes and moves happens at the speed that he understands it, and we're kind of being caught up along as we go, which is, really fun with this sort of epic scope, where you're just like, all right, now we're in between universes. Now all the gods are smacking Thanos at the same time and the world's rippling, and it all just kind of tracks. They do a really George Perez, that god of a penciler, fucking keeps up with the narrative so well that it's really fun if you're not dumb.
To that end that he's arrogant, which I do think he is at some level, but it's interesting, the character I kept in my head comparing him to and thinking, wow, they're actually relatively different, is Doom. Not just because Doom, we did a story, Secret Wars, on this podcast. We read it and talked about it. We didn't, we didn't write it or anything. But in that, Dr. Doom is the central villain. And I think that Thanos and Dr. Doom are two of the kind of not just only in terms of power, but in terms of sort of character gravitas, two major villains in the Marvel Universe. And it's interesting to think that they're only similar. This is the point I'm groping towards blindly. They're only similar in terms of the sort of first sort of superficial sense. And I was thinking about Doom is really arrogant, loudly and shitty and immediately. it's sort of if someone opposes him, how dare you touch Doom's armor, or think that how dare you not show up with a cappuccino for Doom? But Thanos, especially in the initial stories, he really allows people to think of themselves as grandiose. He really is sort of deviously, he's more of I know that you're about to, your balls are going to explode in a second, and I'm going to have a small grin knowing that. And then after he defeats the character, the villain, the opponent, maybe brags a little bit about it deviously as they melt or whatever. But I think it is funny that he really isn't exclaiming his own grandeur loudly as a character most of the time.
Well, there's that line, I think it's in The Godfather, where he said, I think it's Marlon Brando, it says that confidence is quiet and that, weakness is, loud and angry. And that's how Thanos is.
Tell that to Doom. Tell that to Doom. No, but yeah. No, I agree.
Did you guys...
It's also persistent in Doom's in Doom's case.
Did you guys find it weird that the rat, who was like a sycophant for Lady Death, that he was wearing gladiator gear? I mean, I get that the rat is like pestilence and is a servant of death, but why was he dressed up like a Roman? I don't know if there's a backstory there or not.
I didn't get that either. And also, he's in the kind of reality of the text, he's just a dead person.
Yeah.
you know, because he mentions that I had, you know, Thanos brags about dying and coming back to the other side. And he was like, I don't know. I'm just dead or whatever. So he's not even like some symbolic appendage of death. He's just some guy that died, apparently, or something, on a, I don't know, Romanite, fucking rat planet. I don't know. I don't want to go. That doesn't sound like a fun place to be. But yeah, so I don't know. I every time I go back to this, I'm more impressed with Thanos as a character. Like, again, for his intelligence, his sort of stoicism. And again, and we haven't talked about this, you know, his name is from the Greek Thanatos, meaning death. His love for death and the macabre, death literally, you know, the abstract, you know, usually represented as feminine entity that he's in love with and has a history with, by the way. And also, I guess, just for the concept of non-being, he's a nihilist. They mention a lot here, but it's fun because I think they mean almost literally in a way we never mean. In when we say someone's a nihilist, and he believes in nil, like in the positive sense of nothing, almost.
Yeah, you had mentioned how like how he's not necessarily cruel here, and I think I like it's funny because I agree, because the parts where he is at his most cruel, I think, in this story, like when he is like completely corrupted by the power that he wields, the things he does and manifests are the kind of things that I feel like if you just asked me to come up with the most fucked up idea I could come up with. Like, just, I mean, in the same way that in just the objective way that I'm just going to like do an algorithm in my head and say some dark shit, but that doesn't really necessarily mean I want it to happen or have ever thought about that happening, you know? And I feel like that's clearly stated. He's like, okay, hold on. Let me just think of the worst thing. And here's my granddaughter dying forever.
Yeah. Almost, yeah. You know. But on those parts, honestly, those are the parts where it feels like Thanos is actually just trying too hard. You know what I mean? Like, but when he's not trying to impress death, I get the sense, and I'm actually always taken by how human the character he is and how at some level, I think the story works at, you know, if anything, like his tragedy, it's like, oh, he's too human. His humanity got the better of him. And I think like, so even his fascinations, right? Like the fact that he finds death beautiful and that he legitimately sees the world that way, that's not totally lost on us. Like, even if we can't take things that far in the macabre, you get the sense that he just sees like rotting flesh and, you know, the idea of things having life escape from their body and all that kind of stuff is just the best thing in the whole world. And I love, by the way, that the story kind of begins with him not like he had everything and he knew it. And then fucking love, man. That's what, like, you know what I mean? Like she just won't love him back. And all of his downfall, like all this just makes sense to me. You know what I mean? Like all of it works as a meaningful character motivation. All the stupid shit that he does over the course of this, that normally we'd be like, well, he's got infinite power. Why did you blah, blah, blah. Once you enter in like, oh, he's in love with somebody. Then not that this is a total get out of jail free card, but it does end up being the god of the gaps for like most of like what would otherwise be plot problems in this.
Yeah. I mean, in a different world, if you know, you had like, if whoever's in charge of the Marvel Studios like went insane, you could make this a really great rom-com where, you know, Thanos wants to get together with death, but it's just like whatever he does, it just falls flat on his face.
Yeah, on that monument, that little monument, castle island, and that they're having. Yeah, absolutely.
That's perfect because like all of his misswings too are because of like some other goofy motherfucker that kind of knows her too, being like, you know, I bet she wants you to fucking juggle. Yeah. I heard she's into jugglers, and he's like, I shall juggle the universe to death. And like, it's all just these like two dudes just kind of miscommunicating shit to him. And he's just like, all right, yeah, I think that's probably it.
Yeah, and it's actually interesting, and we'll get into those sort of other characters as we go, but, like, it is interesting because Thanos is this, you know, very bright, sort of Promethean character. I think, in, you know, Promethean almost literally in certain ways. But at the same time, he is often a mortal surrounded by immortal figures. And he and Mephisto are really interesting together, this sort of person you were talking to, because, like, in some sense, it's very clear that Thanos is superior to, you know, Mephisto. I mean, and not just in that he's amassed all his power and he's eclipsed things like demons or whatever, but there's a way that, like, you know, Mephisto is got a sort of singular nature. You know, he is a kind of two-dimensional thing. Like, you know, whereas Thanos has got this, you know, profound, unique place in the cosmos. At the same time, I think that Mephisto is very good. He's refined over the millennia ways of basically finding what mortal weaknesses are and playing them against each other. So in certain ways, he's a sort of perfect character to put there. And you can see also Thanos' sort of desperation. He would want anyone to tell him, how can I get this chick to talk to me? Or whatever. So, he, you know, I mean, you can see there's a sort of well-written desperation there that Mephisto can exploit.
Yeah, he's, to her, he is just like an Uber driver who's there to do a job and, you know, do the job and leave. You know, you're not a person to me. You're just like a functionary in my life. And he just like does not get it.
Or maybe he does. And that, like, he can't accept that no,
yeah, for this far now.
Well,
yeah.
Well, that's, and we'll go into our story after we talk about the art real quick, but or for as long as we should. But there's something interesting about, like, no, he does get it. I get, now that I think about it, he does get that he's just a functionary, and he's like, I'm gonna need to get a serious promotion if she's gonna respect me. But there aren't too many subtle options of promotion available. It's either like janitor or like I own the company. And so, anyway, we'll get to it in a second. But let's talk about the art. I am deeply... there's a bit of story here, by the way. Again, not a history podcast, so I'll try to bridge it a little bit. But what did you guys think generally? We have two major pencilers and some other people we'll talk about. But, like, we have Ron Lim, who does, obviously, Thanos Quest. And then he also does the end of Infinity Gauntlet. And then we have George Perez.
I mean, I loved it. The crazy cosmic backgrounds kind of reminded me of, I think, Jim Steranko, when you see the guy who did Doctor Strange in the 60s. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it was, yep, like, it, I don't know if Lim has done acid, but it's, he was able to, like, get these kind of, you know, fantastical sort of backgrounds that I enjoyed. And also the, mm-hmm, the way he framed the narrative, you'd have, like, these big rectangular blocks of, like, really dynamic action, like one by one by one. It was almost cinematic the way he put the different frames together.
Yeah, like, well said. Ron Lim had had a lot of practice, because he had this, I mentioned before, this comic book came from, or sorry, this story came from, it sort of spun out of what was going on in the Silver Surfer comic at the time. And that was Jim Starlin and Ron Lim. So Ron Lim had time to sort of, like, really sort of develop a lot of his characters like Thanos and Silver Surfer, and just sort of get an overall sense of how to sort of construct cosmic comics from Marvel. They had low key been, and Jim Starlin had, like, been creating what would be the Marvel cosmic universe. Jim Starlin and the artists that worked with him at the time are probably as responsible for cosmic Marvel more than anybody, except maybe Jack Kirby. And one more thing to that end, there's something interesting about it too, because the thing about Marvel cosmic, especially under Jim Starlin, and why he's kind of the godfather of all that, is that cosmic comics used to sort of be more just an extension of the kinds of IPs and characters or whatever that would go out into space. So, like, much of Marvel's cosmic, I don't know, Expanse got created by, you know, the Avengers dealing with the Kree and the Skrull, or the Shi'ar with the X-Men. Jim Starlin kind of started creating space adventures, let's say, that existed just out in space, that were their own landscape, that wasn't just derivative of whatever the story needs of Spider-Man, Avengers, X-Men, Fantastic Four, and stuff like that. So that had been going on with the Silver Surfer and with these creatives specifically, and then you get the story. And I think that explains why this feels, it's already a world that has really been fine-tuned visually and story elements before we even begin the proto story here. Sorry, I know that was long-winded, but I just wanted to get
over. No, well, that makes sense why it's so good and well executed, because they'd been developing this stuff for a while. This is just in such stark contrast to the crossover we did with Marvel and DC, which is just like such a bag of crap compared to this.
It is a very rough versus, to me, a masterful attempt. So I give you that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, like, the toyability or just like the sheer like audacity of this, the cash grab that was represented by DC versus Marvel. I don't think this had no intent to be for kids. I don't think.
Yeah.
Like, this was there's nothing toyability really about this. And, your favorite superheroes are punk bitches and they're just to buy time for like two adults in the room to fucking work something out.
Yeah.
And that's such an interesting thing to do with your fucking lineup, like kill half of them and then make the other half pointless, right, to the actual, make us watch each one of them die pathetic death.
And this, by the way, is massively successful when this is coming out. And I agree with your instincts there, Wendell, like there's something really weird about the fact that this feels so different than anything else that's coming out at the time. And the fact that it's successful means that there's a kind of story that comics generally, like in terms of style, in terms of substance, that the audience clearly has a desire for that is not characteristic of what's being published at the time by the big two publishing houses. All right. I mean, it's like this and Youngblood. Like, so, you know what I mean? Not to shit too much on Rob Liefeld, but it there's such poles of you know, talent or whatever.
And just to speak on the art, I just would like to go on record right now to say how embarrassed and ashamed I am to have ever tried to critique anything George Perez does. Like, this man, every time it's like every other episode where we've chosen something where George Perez is just completely reinventing the art.
Yeah.
And it's fucking beautiful. Like, and that's what I meant. Like, this narrative in and of itself is so high-minded that I understanding that you are going to keep up with it, that, like, George Perez, for him to keep the illustrations mapped to the Lovecraftian level of expression in the way parallel universes and, like, primordial god avatars of vague emotions and concepts are represented, was blown away by how not dated it was.
Let me throw a spanner in the works here, because people that are really in, like, aware of this, I guess, are also, like, will tell you that this is the one that George Perez didn't finish. So you'll notice that the art, even though I think that they picked a really smart guy with Ron, a really smart choice with Ron Lim, a guy whose work is not, especially at this time, not so dissimilar from George Perez. Sorry. As a matter of fact, like, it's interesting because the page that Ron picks up on Infinity Gauntlet, even though you can tell if you're looking, it doesn't feel like an abrupt change in art. It's the one literally where Hulk and Drax are punching Thanos, and then the next one where Hulk is punching him and shrinks, that's then Ron Lim's art. And then it's pretty much still telling the same sort of story. And I'm going to go further a little bit because, again, George Perez has been, you know, well lauded. He's a living legend. I think if I had to pick the greatest comic book artist in the history to ever do it, I think I pick George Perez. So I'm not, like, when I say I actually think this is Ron Lim's baby, I think Ron Lim shines here. This is my favorite stuff Ron Lim's ever done. The reason I say that, one, as I mentioned, a lot of the character design Ron Lim actually did in the pages of Silver Surfer, a lot of the characters that are going to populate this story, Ron Lim kind of helped really give you, at this time, the modern version of that. I think that the Thanos Quest art, it never gets better. Everything we read, that's the absolute best. Some of that is the colorist. I had to look up Tom Vincent. He just did Thanos Quest. It's fucking beautiful to me. The color, I mean, it's like 70s, like, yes, like, cover art. Like, just beautiful stuff. And also, I think nobody does Thanos like Ron Lim. I think if I look at his Thanos, the face especially, that he does versus George Perez, I gotta go Ron Lim's Thanos.
Nobody gets that scrotum chin like
I don't know.
Lim does.
That's right.
And
the smile
the, like,
for me. It's his smile. It's perfect.
See, the twinkle eye thing. The twinkle eye just choice. Because it's literally a choice that is constantly used. But never getting, like, never tiring. Every time it happens, you are a little, like, it's off-putting. Like, his, like, you have no idea what his eye is doing. And it's fucking impactful. And, yeah, no, okay. Yeah, Ron Lim for the win.
And we could get into more details. And I think Chris was a little bit more specific just in terms of, like, what, how it functions and works. We've talked about George Perez. I've talked about Ron Lim on the show before. I mean, they really are flawless visual storytellers. They really know their way around an action scene, which is a much sort of like lost, like sub art form, I think, in comic books. So there's just so many things that work about it mechanically. Can't say enough good stuff. Last thing I'll say about the art, and you guys can say something too if you have anything else. The cover of Infinity Gauntlet, number one, is for me maybe the greatest cover of any comic book ever. I have a t-shirt that has this. They have so many posters. It's regularly picked as like one of the top 10 covers of in comic history. There's a reason. Look at that. If you look at it now, listener, it's a goddamn opera.
It's good. It's a little.
It's a
busy,
visual opera. It's amazing.
Yeah, it's good.
Fuck you. No. Like now. Okay. I will say this. What's really interesting, if we're talking about flaws, I can't even say flaw. It's just a weird thing. It has. Because all these characters that should embody the story, right? Most of them are, you know, make sense and are correct. But then they have Cersei and Hawkeye, whose contribution in the first issue is just to disappear. And Nick Fury and his assistant at the time. It's the character that I can't remember her name because it's too long. It's the one that Julia Louis-Dreyfus is going to play. Like Valentina, Europa, Dominguez, Ricardo Montalbán. I can't remember. Anyway. And their sole contribution in the whole story is to be like, man, we don't even know what's going on. It's crazy. We're a shield. We don't even know. That's their whole thing they do. But they still made the cover for some reason. But either way, it's gorgeous. Okay.
You know who didn't make the cover, but I was wondering, why are you there? It's 91. Cloak from Cloak and Dagger. Like, was he popular in the 90s? Or I thought he was more like a
70s
or 80s guy.
No, so there's a... there's a couple things here. I mean, popularity isn't the exclusive thing, right? So... there's a few things that go into this. We don't really do editorial history so much, but I mean, I am familiar with some of it where Jim Starlin, first of all, had to ask Tom DeFalco, who was the editor-in-chief at the time, you know, who he could have. And he wasn't allowed to have most of the X-Men initially. And he actually had to be like, hey, you got to give me some X-Men. The X-Men office didn't want to let him have anything, so he gets Cyclops and Wolverine. Some of the others were just choices. Like, you know, I mean, he said he wanted, like, Thor, Captain America, Iron Man. They don't have the Fantastic Four, you'll notice. They get excluded. I'm sure some of it's for paring down. But then the other thing, I don't know Cloak specifically, but, like, one, there was a 90s Cloak and Dagger series that was probably, you know, relatively... at the time, well written, but it also might've just been something he liked. I know some of the character choices, by the way, were literally just because Jim Starlin had a few scenes in his head that he thought would be cool to do. One I can think of is the Captain America scene that where he confronts Thanos, you know, he's like the last man standing. And then the other one was Wolverine and Hulk, where Adam Warlock goes in to tell him like, hey, we might need you to sanction Thanos. Because you guys are killers or whatever. That was it. He included them because he thought of that scene first. But yeah, I think much of them is like he's gonna, you know, has to come down to a manageable number, and some of those are probably going to just be like, who do I think fills it out interesting?
Okay, I mean,
yeah, and who you could maybe put over.
I don't dislike Cloak. It's just, you know, it could easily have been Man Thing. It seemed like an obscure choice. I guess he dislikes a character.
Yeah, and I think he's visually different than a lot of the other characters. The way he's going to attack is going to be different, you know, that kind of stuff. But okay, so let's get into the story, right? I mean, we've sort of talked a lot about it. We began with Thanos Quest, and I could spend, you know, hours and hours on each one of these, you know, in Chris is like, no, please don't. On each one of these encounters, but it's basically divided between two comic books. There's Thanos Quest Book 1 and Book 2. And we divide the, at that time, owners of each Infinity Gem. You know, he takes out the first three and then the next three. And ostensibly, it's the in-betweener, champion, the runner, then the collector. Missing one. No, sorry.
The gardener.
Yeah, the gardener's the third one. Then the runner, then the collector, then the games master. I think it's an interesting one. He outsmarts everybody, but he kind of, after he gets one gem, he kind of leverages that gem's ability to get the next one, and then the fact that he has two gems to get the third one, three gems to get four, that kind of stuff. Were there any that sort of stood out to you about this? Any specific thing without just going through each of them, you know?
I really like the, we had shared some pages in the chat earlier, and I really like the Gardner interaction. Mm-hmm. Mainly because at like that point, and because with every confrontation, he understands more about each stone, and also mm-hmm. has some new thing he can do that he doesn't really let on to out of the gate. I love the just his like factual breakdown of how the gardener was using the stone. I love how he like tells each person before he takes it from them, like how they aren't even using it right, and then either turns it on themselves or uses one of the other stones he's already gotten to
That's kind of true. The first two, I do think this is sort of curious, and actually does this with the runner. When characters are stupid, he lets them be stupid, and when characters are smart, he respects their intelligence. So, you know, with Champion and Runner and the In-Betweener, he very much lies. He just suggests with In-Betweener, he sort of just says, you know, oh, I want your help I want to leave Death's service and you'll protect me and things like that. So it's a complete ploy, as he says. With Champion, he pretends to just be like, I want to fight a tough guy because you're so tough. With Runner, he kind of acts as if he's in more danger than he is. But they're easy to trick. Whereas with, you know, he out bargains the collector, he out games the games master. I agree. The Gardener is to me my favorite little short story there. And I think one, because we see a kind of like, I don't think it's meant to soften Thanos as much as it maybe does a little bit. I think it's more about refining exactly what he's interested in. And that, like, you know, he's like, I have no interest in, I respect you as an artist. I'm an artist of a kind too. Please just give me the gem. And he, you know, as he mentions, he finds a little regret that he has to destroy this guy to take his stone, because I don't think he's a pure, you know, masturbatory sadist. He just has this goal of being, you know, with death as an equal.
Yeah. Yeah. And I didn't, and like, what I meant was that, like, none of these guys are actually fully using their stone full potential and, or like understanding the, like, precisely how it is, you know, giving them what they want, which is, you know, it's really fun to like see how they're using it and just be like, oh, okay, yeah, it's a magic rock that makes plants look good.
I should have, yeah, that's a really good
point. He takes it down to a granular level. Mm-hmm. And yeah,
I should have mentioned that before, actually. So I kind of forgot how this story really begins. The idea is, again, death brings Thanos back from death, brings him back to life, and says to him, essentially, I want you to kill half of the life in the universe. Because death has become incensed that there are now more living beings than there have ever been dead, than are dead, essentially. And so she gives Thanos this quest, right? And he sees in a tool that she has, a fixture called the Infinite Well, he discovers not just the gems, but their purpose and their story. And you're right. The Soul Gems, by the way, had existed. They were called the Soul Gems before. Now they were all called the Soul Gems. They had existed and were powerful, by the way. Like they were like he had compiled I think them before and it was well understood they could destroy many many things, but no one really understood their actual purpose and essence, and he gets it. And I actually like there's something about like, well, why didn't fucking Death know this since he's got the portal or the fountain or what is it, like the well or infinite well or whatever.
Well, yeah,
And I think it's because she's really happy with her station in life. She doesn't need to go looking for more things. She's pretty content to just be dead and be Death or whatever. But yeah, so he, in other words, he's, because of this unique situation, found, gained insight as to their true nature and their ability. All of these other beings, you know, these lofty characters are wearing them basically like baubles. And I even love that moment. There's this great thing where he tips his, he tips off to the collector what he's up to, that he wants these stones because he needs to know what the other elders know. And he risks, okay, if he figures out how to use this fucking thing, because the collector has the reality stone, they're all goddamn dead. He was like, well, I'm going to die. And he just sort of sits there on his like space throne vehicle, his Metron chair. Yeah, exactly. Looking at his watch like, he's like, I knew that guy was a fucking idiot. He was like, for all his resources and power, metaphysics was never his specialty or whatever. And then, yeah. And that's also fun in Thena's quest that he actually does take several risks. He almost loses a couple times. Champion almost gets through his force field. The runner almost decimates him. He just can't shut the fuck up. And even with the game master thing, at least from the reader, it seems like he might lose. But anyway, yeah. So anybody got anything else before Thanos quest, before we get into the kind of like more,
well, it's not thing. Even that, you know, the collector is an idiot, you know, it's just that Thanos has his laser like focus. I really want to get these gems, and collector's like, well, you know, I'm more interested in like hanging out with these weird birds that I've, you know, robbed from other people. So I'm just going to, you know, have my gem. But yeah, Thanos is just taking everybody's stuff because he's a monomaniac. He has one goal and he gets it done.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think that like the fact that Thanos outsmarts many of these characters, with the exception of sort of like Champion and Runner, the characters that have less, let's say cerebral, fascinations or whatever, the other characters aren't actually stupid. Like Inbetweener, who, by the way, is not an elder of the universe. He just happens to have gotten one of the gems. He's sort of an odd man out here. He was basically created by Lord Order and Master Chaos. I probably have that backwards, Master Order and Lord Chaos or whatever. As like kind of, because they are opposites, obviously. They create this thing that sort of can do both of their bidding. And this was in a Silver Surfer story. It's a great one, Inbetweener versus Galactus. You don't get from this how fucking powerful the Inbetweener is. Like, the whole idea is that, like, when he says, like, you could help me fight Death off, that's very within the Inbetweener's, like, power level. It's very cool. And it's really cool that, again, the Inbetweener is very high level in terms of, like, his power and intellect, but Thanos just happens to have worked out the one thing that he didn't, which is his prison isn't going to allow him to use his powers. But anyway, I'm just trying to underscore the point that these characters aren't actually meant to be dumb. For the most part, it's just that Thanos is uniquely sort of situated, and as you mentioned, he has that kind of focus that he's going to find the flaws that they're not going to be able to see. But okay, so, and I love that. Okay, so wonderful build up. Now he's achieved Godhead, and that's really the beginning of our story, at least in terms of Infinity Gauntlet. I love how Infinity Gauntlet begins, which is that like he's reached fucking near omnipotence, but, and not, you know, I don't want to sound overly heterosexual because I'm certainly not, but like, it's like, even after Godhead, fucking chicks, man, like he still can't do anything to like make this his lady happy or whatever.
Yeah. Okay. So I wanted to ask you guys this because, I feel like this is something I recognized, but I wasn't sure when the transition happened. So, when we first see Thanos interacting with Lady Death, she is a skeletal figure in a like purple robe. But am I wrong in thinking that like the first time that her visage changes is after he has collected? So once he has all the Infinity Gems, Suddenly she has skin and hair and she looks like a woman. Is that?
No, that's coincidence.
Okay. I didn't know because like it bounced back and forth depending on who was like talking in the scene. Mm-hmm. It would be like, oh, Mephisto's like, oh shit, I'm in Lady Death's chamber. There's a skeleton up there. But then when Thanos mm-hmm. is talking to her, at a certain point, it was always just like a Greek looking woman.
Yeah,
Mediterranean.
I think this is closer to like Hel or Hela, you know, like in the more Anglo thing where it's like, you know, in Norse mythology, Hel is a goddess that has like half a young woman's face and half death on the other side.
Okay.
And I was going to say, even away from this story. Now, don't get me wrong. I mean, you could be right. And if we went back through it, maybe Starlin is choosing based on certain things. But even before this story, Lady Death has always alternated between a skeletal gotcha. Face and a beautiful woman's face or whatever. But like I said, it could be the case that it's being used with more.
I thought that was such a cool idea. I just thought it was a cool idea because like he does express like he mourns having risen so far above her in his like he actually is sad when he is not when he runs past being her equal. And I feel like that was the first time I noticed her like that was the first time I saw her like as a woman that wasn't a skeleton.
That's fair, and that's probably well timed. But it's just to say that motif does predate this comic or whatever. And I did want to say too, I guess before moving too much further into the story, even before we get to the beginning of Infinity Gauntlet, at the end of Thanos Quest, there is this moment which is right up there with Rod Serling twist. You know, with like, there was time now, kind of, where he's like become, you know, he's become omnipotent, and very quickly it dawns on him that Lady Smith, Black Mbazu, why do I keep saying that? Lady Death will not be, it doesn't think like, one, it isn't clear she wanted a mate. That doesn't get brought up much, but that like, that once he achieves this level of power, she's now going to be his, you know, in his service, which is not what she wants.
I thought you said wanted to mate, and I was like, I don't think that that's even what Thanos wanted either. Yeah. You're like, I don't think she wanted to mate today.
A mate, which is actually probably mate. I only use that noun because it's actually used in the text, but yeah. So we begin there, and we begin with a kind of impasse. And much of the beginning of our story is Thanos sort of coming up really futilely with things that absolutely are not going to work. I mean, at some level, you can say it's because Mephisto has sort of like put these ideas in his head. But you also get the sense that like, if not for Mephisto, there would be no attempts to do anything. You know, he doesn't seem to have a single idea.
I feel like her, that rotten white guy that gets blowed up last,
her kind of herald
that is like her I feel like that guy was also sort of just talking a bunch of mess. Like I wasn't even, there were like parts of it where I understand that he really was supposed to be acting as the voice of like sort of her Metatron or whatever. But like the rat also seemed to kind of have that same sort of, I guess, station, but gets blowed up. Mm-hmm. And like there were also times where you're not sure, like, maybe this guy's just playing with a fucking love drunk.
No,
fool,
I don't think,
like, maybe this guy's just,
I don't take that to be the case. I mean, maybe, but I think that like, you could say they're not just her voice, like that they are emissaries that are talking for her, but I don't get the sense that either one of them have like their own agenda or they are manipulating Thanos. One, I mean, it's not to be lost. Lady Death is one of the most powerful cosmic abstracts, you know, so it's really unlikely that just sort of this idiot that she's brought to death would be saying things that she didn't want him to say right in front of her. You know, I mean, it's certainly possible, but I think it's less there or whatever.
I think I got hung up on the like on that mechanic just because like I have seen Death illustrated in other ways where she is just straight up talking, like just up flirting with Deadpool and stuff. And so it's like that, I couldn't really like get a beat on whether this guy was really just trying to make sure Thanos
didn't succeed. Because again, what happens in Deadpool later on is like, That, I mean, it's nobody gets to control these characters. I know. But by no one that came afterwards, so it's there's no way that it would like this was be like in relationship with that in retrospect. But I think more so like there's something that he's going for about like initially she won't speak to Thanos directly because he's far beneath her, so she speaks through one of her emissaries, and then later when the roles are reversed, it's a very conspicuous message they're only inverted, they're not equals. She won't speak to the great godhead that is Thanos now directly because that would be almost disrespectful in her sense, right, from on the other end or whatever.
So great.
Yeah. And oh yeah, exactly. And by the way, I love that we begin very quickly with the snap. You know, basically he's...
It's an afterthought. He's like, I don't know.
Well, the idea is, you know, Mephisto is kind of talking to him about, you know, these are maybe ways to woo her. Mephisto's also the one that suggests, like, she's a dark lady. She's going to need a dark dude. You got to show that you can do gross things. And then he is like, look at this lady. Her name's Nebula, an important character to our story. She said she was my granddaughter. And so I've made her this half-life, half-death, disgusting, she smells. And that doesn't, like, nothing's going to work, right? But that doesn't work. And then Mephisto, like, kind of reminds, or Thanos actually might have come up with this one on his own. The whole point that this all started, he needed to get a certain amount of power to kill half of the life on the universe, and he does it. He's like, oh, yeah, I forgot. Wasn't I supposed to do something? Oh, yeah, of course you're mad at me. I didn't do the thing I said I was going to do. And there's something really cool about the devil, Marvel's devil, Mephisto, right before he's like, it's like he dusts himself off and he's going to go walk out. He's like, I'm going to go kill everybody or half of everybody. He walks up there and you've got that little, nice little line where Mephisto's like, he's going to do it. Like, oh, shit, he's going to do it. You know, like his friends going up to punch a cop. Like, it's just really cool.
Yeah, that sick son of a bitch is really going to pull it off.
And then he does. Yeah, no. And that's kind of where, kind of, it's not exactly the case, but that's kind of what, how our heroes get involved.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of funny how, yeah, like, absent-minded he's become, because it's like, it starts off the first time you see him, he's like, oh yeah, sorry, I was making the word God out of a planet, and then blowing it up. Yeah. The word God in English just floating in space. And he was like, oh, yeah, yeah, no, I did say I'd do that. And then that happens so, like, offhandedly. And then and then the narrative switches to what everybody, like, all of our heroes on Earth are looking at and, you know, on different planets, right, that we're familiar with. And it's just them dealing with a hurricane. There's nothing they do in response to it other than react to how crazy it is. They're like, oh, shit, Japan's gone now.
Yeah, there's a few things that are happening kind of at the same time, right? So Thanos is doing his shit that has cosmic sort of echoes and ripple effects throughout the universe, really devastating. And actually, it's easy to sort of compress a few things. There's actually several things he does. We'll get to them in a second. But I'll say also, Adam Warlock, quickly, we're told who it is, has just resurrected himself from the Soul World to put a stop to Thanos. So he's also preparing his defense because he is familiar with Thanos. He died fighting him before, and he understands that only he can really mount a defense against Thanos. So he kind of resurrects. I think in one of the crunchier parts of this, where he and Pip the Troll and Gamora all come out of the Soul World, and they have to, possess the bodies of recently dead people that then turn onto them.
Yeah.
It's for me, it's the one part I'm like, that's really unnecessary. Just have them come back. It's all that's going to really happen anyway. But
I thought that was going to be a much bigger thing.
Right.
A side note, not related to the story, but sure, Soul World would make a great 70s like dance movie, like Car Wash, but it's dancing.
Well, and also I should say, you don't really get this from the text so much. Soul World is sort of, it's either in just all taking place within the Soul Gem, or the gem is kind of like a conduit to it. It seems kind of they're both true at the same time, you know, since soul worlds and soul gems aren't really subject to normal space and time relationships or whatever. Yeah, I just thought it was
like inside the gem, and the gem is like its own microcosmic universe. There's a issue of X-Men Unlimited where Juggernaut goes inside the gem where he gets the power from, and it's his own.
The Gem of Sidorak.
It's its own little universe, so I was fine with that.
The Ruby of Sidorak. But the only thing about it, I think where that gets twisted a little bit, is that, like, also the world of Soul is over the entire universe as well. Right? Like, in other words, like, all, because the Soul Gem also governs all, essentially, spirit, all living things, which invariably are also, like, out in, you know, out in the regular world or whatever. So yeah, I just think it's a bit vague, right? So Adam Warlock has come back from the Soul World to defeat Thanos. And I did want to just return just briefly to the idea that, like, so Thanos wipes out half of all life, and that includes the heroes. So half of our heroes are killed or whatever. And there is a moment where, you know, Captain America's in Avengers Mansion and, like, oh, Cersei and Hawkeye, like, they're, and they disappear, and it's like, you get this, it's like Captain America's like, oh no, those two, I loved them. Oh, like, if you want to get rid of Mockingbird, you might want to do that to her. I actually think she does die, but anyway. But yeah, so as I say, the heroes of Earth are reeling from all this sort of stuff, and Adam Warlock has now contacted Doctor Strange at the same moment that Silver Surfer has crashed into, like, Doctor Strange, into the Sanctum Sanctorum to warn him about Thanos. They adapted that. It's a very specific scene for the Hulk did it in the movies. But
was that part where Silver Surfer crashes into Doctor Strange's pad? Was that like a callback to when he arrives on Earth to Herald Galactus? Does he crash into Earth like that, or is it more like he comes in kind of surfing around?
I think, no, but I think you're kind of right, right? So I don't think there's this moment where he crashes down to be like, oh, Silver Surfer or whatever. Galactus or whatever, you know, because in that story he tells Johnny kind of surreptitiously where the ultimate nullifier can be found or whatever to give to Reed. But I think that you're right that it is like the idea of him being a herald to, you know. And
yeah.
Also...
Oh boy, I thought my heralding days were over.
Yeah, so there's also a moment in a Silver Surfer comic, I think it's Silver Surfer 50 actually, where before this all goes down, Silver Surfer has a fight with a Thanos stone statue right after he gets the Infinity Gauntlet and beats the shit out of him. And Silver Surfer is leaving to warn them. So, like, he and Adam Warlock both kind of just... good timing, I guess, or I guess they're both like, hey, Doctor Strange is our point of contact. And then Doom is like, what the fuck is going on? My readings tell me that my old pal Doctor Strange, what a dick, has got some cosmic shit going on. That's for me. I'm going to get that shit. So they all sort of converge, and then they meet up with the Avengers, essentially. But then, and this is, I think, is interesting too, I like the back and forth here. While the, you know, Avengers and Earth Heroes and Adam Warlock and Doctor Strange are all kind of getting their shit together and just like, what the fuck are we going to do? Because he's basically Super Jesus now. What could we possibly do? Things are still happening in Thanos, you know, date world. Like, he's still trying to get it in. I mean, I hate to be crass, but that is sort of what's going on. And, you know... it's not working. Nothing he's doing is working. So he has a fucking hissy fit. But because he is the powers of God, like with a capital G, it creates this massive rift or you know, ripple or whatever, this, you know, shockwave of destruction, and fucks up the entire universe. And I like this because I think that, or it's worth sort of underlining here, that the him snapping out all life and that thing, that destruction wave, are different things. And they just happen to be, happen in quick succession. It fucks up the Kree Empire and the Skrull Empire and all across the universe we can expect. But on, it kills Japan. It destroys all of Japan, the Western seaboard. It just fucks shit up entirely. And it cuts off Asgard and all the gods that like were chilling on Asgard to plan. Because everybody at that point, it was like, okay, some people were starting to figure out that Thanos is, you know, an issue, is an ascendant threat. And they're all trying to figure shit out. And it just so happens that nearly everyone dies instantly just because he's fucking, you know, has blue balls and is angry or whatever.
It just reminded me of the Rick and Morty episode where they have to do the talent show basically on a galactic scale, and these giant heads arrive, and it causes all this.
Yeah, show me what you causes got.
Causes all these tidal waves and earthquakes just by them appearing.
Yeah, like incidental destruction that Thanos didn't even know he was doing.
Yeah, like. Thanos has mad Rick energy in Thanos Quest, I feel like at a certain point, because he's like so on the up and up about like understanding what's happening above the person he's with, where it's like, I'm sure you wonder how I became in, or how I came into possession of this stone. He's like, I sure am not, but I bet you're going to say it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And he has this really weird kind of, like, jaded, sardonic sort of energy. Every time he gets a stone, he's like, I don't fucking care, yeah, man. Like, I'm walking away with
it. I think Thanos, to that end, it's like he sort of sees past people a bit. He's like, has his own designs, and Chris mentions he's, like, monomaniacal. But I think he sees a lot of those people as, like, silly and also specifically insignificant relative to what he's doing, what he's about, or whatever. Yeah, which is very Rickian, right? He, like, sees those people as, like, beneath them and insignificant, but it's kind of like the contempt you might have for like a termite pile. Like, it's, you know, less about like, ah, I've got to stop you, and more like, look at the silly termites making their silly mound. Where were we? So at this point, now they finally got their shit together, and they're going to confront Thanos. Doctor Strange, basically, and Adam Warlock and Silver Surfer and all those characters, they all meet with the Avengers, and they're like, okay, let's, Doctor Strange, grab a few more people, make them powerful. We don't need fucking, Hawkeye's dead. Who else is worthless? Don't, you know, just nobody that's got a skill. We don't need a lot of skills, okay? We're going to need people that can, like, crush boulders and stuff. Okay, so he gets a pretty cool menagerie. I like the group that gets summoned, right? The Earth Heroes, because outside of a few, like you mentioned Cloak, he's maybe a little understacked. You know, they get people that feel like they could fight in space, you know, and feel like really, you know, buff and stuff like that. It's good stuff.
For an hour.
What's that?
People that can fight in space for an hour, yeah, real hard.
We get some...
Which is such a strange thing that, like, kind of... It's not strange, or it would be strange if there were also weren't all of these other layered conditions around how this was even gonna fucking work. From Adam's perspective, he's like, all right, I got an hour for y'all to breathe and waste his time while I do all this extra shit.
Doctor Strange did the spell for them to all breathe in space.
Oh, but, yeah. But that's I'm with him. Yeah.
Yeah, in a weird way, you know, Adam Warlock has really undefined powers. I mean, he's got a set of shit he could do that you associate with, like, demigod cosmic characters like the Eternals or something like that. Like, he's strong and fast and fly and blasty. But really, I think it's nice that they include Doctor Strange, but they really could have just, like, he becomes kind of a mechanism. He becomes a Swiss Army knife for Adam Warlock to use. I think probably they could have just had Adam do it. But I like that you get Strange. It's cool. Involvement anyway.
And I really, really just right here want to ask and give Jared the opportunity to answer. What is going on with Thor at this point in time? Because it's very obvious that this is not...
Boy, you didn't have to ask me, but I appreciate... very, very briefly, you can tell when Jim Starlin wrote this story that he did not intend to have Eric Masterson's Thor. But he was sort of saddled with it. The reason I say that, there's certain times when they call Eric Asgardian. Also, later on, and this is the biggest thing, Adam Warlock picks out three characters that have seen into his soul at the end, right? You get Doctor Strange, Thanos, who was it again? It's
Silver Surfer.
Yeah, that's right. Doctor Strange, Silver Surfer, and Thor. Now, the reason is because initially... when Adam Warlock's first appearance was when he was him, where he just looked like Rocky Horror or Rocky from Rocky Horror Picture Show. He kidnapped Sif and fought Thor. So it was one of the first encounters he had. And, you know, Thor beats him, but considers it like sees that he's good, basically, or whatever. Anyway, so the point is that, so Starlin has that scene in mind and writes it or whatever. But the fact is that Thor at the time had been replaced by this character, Eric Masterson. So I'll try to abridge it. Thor got connected to the soul of Eric Masterson in that same Don Blake 60-second way because he failed to save Eric, who's just like being a civilian architect or whatever. And he asked his father to save him. The only way they could do is to join them too. So you get back to the 60-second thing, right? But then Thor kills Loki at one point because Loki kills this civilian lady. And then Thor gets banished because he killed Loki. You can't kill another immortal if you're immortal, apparently. I don't know. So Eric Masterson, that mortal he was bound with, replaces him where now he looks like Thor, but he's got a human mind or whatever. And that's what we're seeing. That's why Thor is like that in this.
Okay. Yeah.
It was actually a pretty good story,
and that's
honestly.
Jared's Thor. Yeah,
yeah, Thor Corner. Jared's Thor. My Thorner.
Yeah.
So the heroes go confront Thanos, and right off the bat, right even before like the cliffhanger, Adam Warlock is like, "Well, I've sent those guys to die. It's pretty clear. We know it's. I mean, you already know, really. Even before you know it's just a distraction, and they're probably gonna die. But it's a really cool fucking fight, right? We get to see, and
it is.
Thanos just. I mean, what I love about this is that they really let the heroes have their due, despite it being basically inevitable and Thanos kind of walking through them. But they get their licks in. It feels back and forth. There's enough drama to it that I think it makes it, you know, it almost makes you feel like, oh, they could do it, maybe. Like, maybe, you know.
The way it's written, a lot of the times it's being narrated by either the observant or from the perspective of either Eros or Adam Warlock, right, where they're describing the fight as it's happening. And there's so many like, and then it all was lost for certain until a sudden Wolverine popped out.
Yeah, yeah.
Gave it what for? Oh, and then everybody's going to rubber. Die again. And then the hunger, blah, blah, blah. Like, there's somebody, like, hope springs eternal again. And, yeah.
And it's you know what's funny, too, is that, like, that thing you mentioned, the perspective, like, they have Eros. This comic does this a lot, which I don't care for. Not because I'm against it. They just don't really commit to it. Like, every new page, every once in a while, like in certain strings of like moments, they'll have different people narrate it. You know, it'll be like all of a sudden Moon Knight is narrating for some reason, but he never really sticks with it long enough to develop it. So like for a while, it'll be like, I don't know, again, Silver Surfer will be kind of like, you know, and I was trying to blah, blah, blah. And then they'll have like, I don't know, fucking Black Widow. And Black Widow will be talking and then she'll get interrupted by, okay, whatever, Black Widow. We don't have fucking time for you. Let's face it. You're not really,
yeah,
you know, can you fly? Okay, well, fuck you. That's not, you don't get to say, you know, first person.
Yeah, it might have been better with one consistent narrator, like the Watcher, but not suck. I just rolled my eyes as soon as the Watcher came into frame because, oh boy, here we go. I can't participate except when it's convenient for me. I hate that.
It's like, oh yeah, but you can tell us all about it, right? You can describe yourself.
I hate
you
that Prime Directive stuff. We have rules except when it's inconvenient for me.
Yeah, exactly. And he looks like a goober too with his giant stupid head. And there is something about the Watcher where it's like, okay, you don't need to be here to look at it. Like, you could be invisible. Like, you're either, like, you're in or out, motherfucker. Like, you don't need to, but anyway.
Yeah, yeah. There's a Venture Brothers character that's kind of like that, where he's like, don't look at me! And that's literally just Watu's energy pretty much every time.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm here to watch.
It's like, he's this giant-headed, ridiculous, water-headed, and then they're like, he's just like, I'm watching, and it's like, why are you dancing then? I don't pay attention to my dancing. It's just to help me look better. It's a cool fucking fight. I can't iterate enough. I think that there had been a lot of like, again, angry Thanos, good characterization, interesting soliloquies and all this kind of stuff. But so far there hadn't been a lot of like just ass whooping, and it's really cool. Like Thor gets a lot of cool hits. I really like that. Really fan, big fan of that. The Wolverines, like, you know, he really, if you're a fan of any of these characters, he really gives you something, like, despite the fact that they're going to get smushed. Like, the Captain America stare down. Everybody's basically been defeated, dude. And he walks up and it's like, fuck you, Thanos. Let's face it, you're Hitler. I'm be honest, I see a lot of people as Hitler. It's kind of my thing. But, yeah.
He breaks his shield and like I
which had not been done a lot. Shot. This might be the first time in comics that had happened.
Yeah. But the final shot before like he's about to fucking just rip him in half, Captain America is standing upright, just eye to eye, just complete, like it's exactly what he deserves in that moment, which is to say like not a threat. But not scared of this punk bitch.
Yeah.
And that's really all you need from Captain America.
Makes you proud to be American.
I completely agree. There are some characters, by the way, right? in this that really do. I mean, they have cool little moments. But, like, God, Iron Man's death and then Spider-Man. Like, it's fucking brutal. It's brutal because of, like, almost because Taraxia kills him. Thanos, I didn't mention it, but Thanos creates this, like kind of, like, living sex Thanosita. Doll to make Lady Death jealous, which is not usually
he made a skinny
how it works, but
Thanos with titties.
Yeah
he made a feminine
Lady Death
Thanos.
Listen, I'm hanging out with Taraxia later. We're just gonna cruise on by and go to the Olive Garden. I don't know if you noticed us walking by right now. Yeah, it was kind of pathetic.
Yeah, because the real life version of that is like you have a new girl, but she's dressed just like you, which is super weird. Hey, I'm just going to have sex with Lady Me, and she loves me for me because we're both me. Like, it's just a weird fucking...
And you also, like, you also pieced her together in front of this your ex-girlfriend, you know? You're just like, oh, look who just walked up. The perfect Thanos lady.
I made this IKEA girlfriend that you're going to... Don't you wish you were made by... The thing, I think the metaphor does fall off. But anyway, so, and then the last moment, of course, just in this little sort of like skirmish, is that it was all a distraction for the Silver Surfer. And I actually love this. I was like, why? He's really powerful. Why isn't he doing anything? He swoops in to try to grab the gauntlet because Thanos had, you know, and I forgot to mention as well, which I guess is important in the story. The whole reason he fights them without just, instead of just wiping them from existence, is because Mephisto convinces him that, like, maybe if you give them a chance to beat you, that'll look more like, you know, courage and bravery, and that'll woo Lady Death. Now, again, this is imbecilic. There's no reason to think she has that kind of, you know, human psyche that she'd be impressed by anything. She's Death, you know, but he's very desperate, so he goes for it, and we need to have a comic or whatever. And so, like I said, back to the end of that part where Silver Surfer swoops in to try to grab it at the last minute and he misses. And it's like, oh, we could have ended right there. And Adam Warlock is very much like, no, we got to start at the hard way. Now we got to fight the hard way, I guess. I got to say, Silver Surfer, despite, you know, failing or whatever, he did luck out with the jobs he had to do in this sort of thing. Like, people that... didn't do so hot in the job thing, Cloak, right? Because that had to be pretty clear he was going to die. Remember, I don't know if you remember this little detail. They were all told what to do strategically. They were all told exactly what moves to make by Adam Warlock. He had worked it out already.
Yeah, everybody knew their job. Their
play. And then you know, Vision also, you know, it wasn't going to work out well. The guy who really lucked out, Doctor Strange, man. It's like, Doctor Strange, you're going to just do the switchboard. And then if somebody like is rendered unconscious or injured, bring them off of the field of battle. That's good for two reasons. One, Strange doesn't have to be in the field of battle. Two, not a real hard job because not a lot of people are injured. Pretty much everybody dies immediately. Like, it's like he doesn't even... He's playing Switch. He doesn't even really have to... So basically they're like, oh fuck. And then I like this. I think this is actually pretty tight writing. You know, it's the kind, this has got an omnipotent being that's got to lose. So clearly there are going to have to be some, you know, plot holes we're just distracted away from. And I think Starlin does a good job of that. This detail I like, which is Adam Warlock wanted to avoid invoking the cosmic deities that he had also assembled, because not because he knew they wouldn't win or something, but because he thinks it runs the risk of actually destroying the cosmos. And that's, I believe that. And moreover, I gotta say, when he assembles all of the cosmic deities, it really gets me. I mean, like, it really, for me, creates the scale, you know, because it's not just like Thor or Zeus or whatever. It's, you know, the embodiment of love or the embodiment of like explosion or whatever. It's like, yeah.
Yeah.
And Starlin just assembles basically every powerful ultimate being that's ever been in the pages of the Marvel Universe and just puts them on in a big splash page. And they fucking fight Thanos, and it doesn't go so well for them either.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that, like, Doom and Galactus are both, like, written true to their character, mm-hmm. where it's like, they both have these moments where it's like they want it to be about them, or, you know, like, or their wants superseding everybody else's.
Right.
And get shut down immediately. Like, or, like, get proven totally wrong. Like, I love the Doom, like, is like a cockroach in a way, where he just keeps getting smacked and then getting up, and he's like, ha ha, Doom again, and then getting blown up. But Galactus also needing some convincing and a little talking to, and being sold on it was good, because I
he gets outvoted too,
because
like he right, just go along with it.
Yeah, because there was one other person who was like, there was one celestial entity that like opted out, I think, because it was like
that was eternity
chaos or whatever.
So the idea, and it gets lost a little bit, it's cleared out clear in the story, but like the idea is eternity is the embodiment of the entire universe. And I actually is a little confused, because before and after this story, eternity's got this other half called infinity. It's like a sort of female half that represents all of time. So he represents all of space. But they kind of just meld that into one character for the purpose of the story, probably just for, like, you know, to streamline it. But the idea is, like, when Thanos gets the Infinity Gauntlet, he basically just usurps Eternity as the avatar of all that is. He becomes Eternity. And you get to see that, you know, as, because, you know, Eternity's that cool, like, starry kind of silhouette figure with a half a face and tentacles or whatever, and so his half a face just ends up in the Eternity after he wins. And then there's that moment, and this is sort of, again, where it's explained to us that, like, this is a stupid mistake for an omnipotent being to make, an omniscient being, I should say. But two things are going on. One is that we're told constantly that Thanos hasn't truly adapted to his omniscience. He has access to all this kind of stuff, but you could think of it like he still seems to have an ego, a singular point of experiential focus, which we assume the omniscient Godhead doesn't have. So he hasn't completely abandoned that. And the short thing is, like, he's still adapting to his omniscience. He's a bit distracted. And then the other thing, and we're told, Adam Warlock stares him down, is like, let me tell some shit to you that you don't like to think about you, kind of stuff, is that he's secretly self-sabotaging. You know, Vision actually mentioned it early in the story, because it had happened before. But that at some level, you know, Thanos doesn't believe that he's, you know, worthy of omnipotence. And maybe another way to say that, which I think is interesting, is it's not really about that for him. He really is in love. He really just wants this to be accepted by the person he loves. It's really not about being God. You know, I mean, he doesn't seem to, I mean, if anything, I think Thanos respects and finds a certain grandeur and beauty in the universe. He doesn't hate it. And he certainly doesn't think, you know, he needs to make it better. He just wants the death to love him or whatever.
I mean, this is literally how some penguins find mates, is going and finding shiny rocks and bringing them to them. And I think, like, at a base, yeah, like, you're right. It was never really actually about doing like attaining this power for himself. It was so that he could be worthy of death. And it's funny, because when you said Vision mentions it earlier, are you talking about that line where he says, like, the only way we could beat Thanos, yeah, or the only way we could beat Thanos is if he didn't want
because
to
the Avengers had fought him before, yeah, and Avengers, yeah, and Captain Marvel before, and then Adam Warlock, and so in both cases, I mean, in some sense, what I really love about what Starlin's doing there as a writer is he is trying to build in a reason for the previous bad writing, or you could say the inevitability that Thanos is going to lose. The only way to make that not just like, oh, whoops, is that there's an actual meaningful reason, and he creates that, which is that Thanos is understands himself to be unworthy. Now, I will say that does exist already in similar, like in Secret Wars. Remember, they say the same thing for Doctor Doom. It's a little bit more subconscious, and they play up the fact that he's this egomaniac, and maybe that's compensating for a system, or what do you call it, a sense of inferiority that's coming out in his dreams, like his subconscious mind or whatever that's sabotaging. With Thanos, it's a little bit more like kind of dialectically just right at the core of his personality or something like that. Either way, we also, this is kind of where the story ends, let's be honest. The next thing that happens is really just to sort of, I mean, it's not, it's interesting, it's fun, it's a hell of a nice little twist, but I'd say in the general structure of the story, that's kind of it. So once Thanos achieves godhood, the way he loses it is he forgets, like, oh, my body's down there with the gems. I forgot about that because I was all like, you know, omnipotent cosmic power or whatever.
Yeah, and I was Jafar.
Exactly,
over here.
Yes. And Nebula inches towards it and grabs the gauntlet. And, you know, there's a cute little thing. He doesn't go too far with it about, like, you know, it's the littlest things. You got to watch them. The littlest Bilbos and Frodos of the world. They'll really stop Sauron and his ring or whatever. And so Nebula kind of, like, gets the gem and just does 1 through 5 of this issue just in, like, a few, like, she defeats the villains, you know, is trying to cope with godhood, defeats the cosmic, blah, blah, blah. And then the way that the heroes actually stop her, which you get a sense, again, I don't want to pick on this too much, but that why couldn't he have done this from the beginning and at all times? Adam Warlock had a special connection to the Soul Gem from one, having it in his possession for a long time before this in several stories, and then also living in the soul world that's inside the gem, and then also being kind of the ruler or the something like that of soul world. So he reaches out from that gem to all of the other gems and wrestles control of, or actually it's kind of there's an order of things, like there's an explosion and then the fucking glove falls off and then everybody goes to get it. And then, you know, it's like the heroes in this get brought back like 7 times, you know, to like, you know,
and they don't remember a thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, Cyclops was choked to death by a force field.
Okay. But that being said, we find basically Adam gets the gauntlet and he's now, you know, and then Thanos is like, well, if I can't win, then I have to go nuclear, and threatens to blow everybody up. Thor, yeah, knocks him away with a hammer. He blows up or whatever. Turns out he's retired to a cornfield to just think about, you know, all what the fuck was all that about? Kind of, I learned something.
Yeah, it ends up being an incredibly epic and, you know, overly dramatic therapy session for Thanos. Like, for him to work through these,
yeah,
two issues, his self-sabotage and, you know, his unrequited love. And, you know, he just really wanted to farm.
And he's sitting, yeah, there in the cornfield. Better to, you know, love and lose than never to love it all and kill half of the galaxy and make some sort of like awful living death effigy, and it better do all that. And then gardening, which is the closest thing,
oh,
to
shit,
do. I think we can admit.
Oh shit, Nebula's birthday is next week.
Yeah, exciting.
Yeah. I love it that Adam Warlock goes to Thanos to ask him, like, for advice on how to be a good user of this, like, hey, so,
right,
like, in your experience, how you fucked,
right,
up, how would you say you wouldn't fuck up this time? Because it's mine,
yeah,
and I'm taking notes.
Because there's something really interesting, and I think this is Starlin, like, okay, so as you say, this sort of ends. Adam Warlock pays Thanos a visit, because they have a buddy relationship. Starlin goes on to write many comics featuring these two, and they become straight up friends. I think it's because they're both like sort of kind of in this fatalistic situation. They're both pretty stoic characters, and they're both sort of they have a kind of like thing that rules them, a principle or a goal in mind that they follow with sort of great duty, and they both respect one another for it, even though it's different. Actually, later on in this sort of broader saga, Thanos is going to be the one that brings out Adam Warlock from a kind of like brooding, like, I don't know if I can go on. He's like, yeah, but you don't really have a fucking option. So just do it and stop being such a bitch about it. It's a really good moment. But anyway, so that's our story. We did Thanos Quest and Infinity Gauntlet. I'm glad we finally covered it on the show. Let's do some final thoughts and we'll do some recommendations and we will get out of here. Let the listener go. What do you think? What are your sort of final thoughts?
I enjoyed it. The art was great and it was a surprisingly psychological story. I expected it just to be like Rock'em Sock'em in the space, but it was about a guy trying to work out a few issues and just on a very grand scale. It was a good story.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Wendell? What are your final thoughts?
This blew me away.
Mm-hmm.
It is something that at the time I was 2 years old when it came out, but something of if I had read this in my teens, I think it a lot of like the value of the storytelling would have been lost on me. Like it is there's no corners cut in this, and like the vision is so clear and so grandiose for like its time. Like I don't think, like, I feel like this should be the ceiling of how big things should be.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like it seems crazy to even talk about going past this as a concept. You know, like everything after this should just kind of exist around the idea that that's as bad as it gets. Mm-hmm. And Lovecraftian in scope. And yeah, that Thanos is such a different character in the comic books and in so many good ways, like in nothing that really imparts judgment on the MCU version.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that, so I love the story. It's one of my, I mean, probably in the top 10 favorite comic book stories, especially for the kind of like superhero genre or whatever. I think what I love about this is that, as you mentioned, it has this crazy ability to have fantastic scope, this massive grandeur, feel really bigger than most of the, I mean, especially when I read this when I was a kid, like this was felt way bigger than anything I'd read before. But the mistake that other crossovers make that this doesn't is this has an incredibly well-focused, well-written, well-edited story at the heart of it. You know, I mean, other crossovers, when they want to sort of suggest to you how big the ramifications and all the corners that touch, they have a tendency to tell really unfocused, sort of all over the place, you know, convoluted sort of, I don't know, all this weird like character filigree. This doesn't do this. This has a very strong sense of what the story's about. It has a incredibly well-developed three-dimensional character that happens to be sort of the villain, and he has a thematic focus. I mean, they're not really reinventing anything in terms of like it is this almost like Rod Serling kind of, you know, Greek tragedy kind of thing, but it's told so well. And it's, to me, it's amazing. The art, obviously we've sung its praises. Yeah. I can't imagine a better version of this. I love it. I'll go ahead and do some pretty simple recommendations. Some of I've already touched on this, Silver Surfer run that this sort of springs out of has many really cool epic stories. I've actually mentioned it on the podcast before, that Jim Starlin worked on, Mark Gruenwald worked on it as well, and Ron Lim is the signature artist. I also think you should read Infinity War, the sequel to this, and then the next sequel, Infinity Crusade. Now, people have a tendency to judge them on the basis that they're really not as good as this. What could be, right? But I actually think they're all, and in some sense, it's like Jim Starlin is trying to retell this story again, but with slightly different circumstances. All that being said, I don't really care that they have, if Ron Lim does the art on both of those sequels, and they have really interesting, like the Infinity War, which is has nothing to do with the movie. It's its own thing. It's a sequel to this. It has a much more sort of like Guy Ritchie kind of like different characters sort of all with their own motivations trying to get different cosmic things moving past each other. Really fun fights and stuff like that. And Infinity Crusade is also really good. I don't know, bumping up of terrestrial characters and cosmic characters. I just think if you like this, even if it's not as good as this, I think you'll still really enjoy those things. So I recommend that strongly. What are your recommendations, Chris?
I'm a big John Carpenter fan. That's not saying a lot. Most people really enjoy his stuff, like particularly The Thing and Halloween. But you should go...
The 9 amazing movies he did in a row.
Like you should go back and watch some of the lesser ones. I just finally, for the first time, watched In the Mouth of Madness with Sam Neill, and it's about an insurance fraud investigator sent out to find a Stephen King-like character, and the Lovecraftian madness that ensues when he goes and finds him. I was really impressed. It had a great ending.
Yeah, fantastic. Lord of Darkness is also really good, too.
Yeah, I watched that one, too, but I just wanted to keep it to one. But yeah, they're both a lot of fun.
my recommendation is going to be probably now that we're just like on a roll here. An episode we do soon, Infinite Crisis, or I'm not Infinite Crisis, Crisis on Infinite Earths, which is also illustrated by George Perez, the DC huge crossover event that happened in '85. I feel like it's really, I would say it approaches scope. It's fun how like George Perez is great and a part of things that all have the word infinite in them.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that is like his wheelhouse, I guess. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a great story. DC does. It's kind of the first time they approach like the concept of the multiverse and the ways that they all like exist parallel to each other. And yeah. It's as big as this tries, or it tries to be as big as this, and I think meets it in some levels.
It's big in a different way. I think it's a flawed story in certain ways, but it's also, it has it has so many good moments, that story. I mean, it's not the most efficient. There's a lot of chaff. It's also, it's one of those things where it's trying to reduce the convoluted nature of the DC universe and in many ways sort of makes it more convoluted. That being said, everybody should read that story. You know what I mean? It's Perez at his finest. It's got amazing deaths. It's got amazing births in certain ways, right? But yeah, fantastic. Oh, I also wanted to mention, I forgot this as a recommendation. Because of this story, because of what Jim Starlin did, it made it just really clear and undeniable that Thanos is the kind of character that can sustain his own stories. It's not like he just always had a, title, but that has uninterruptedly gone on. But every once in a while, he'll get a really good miniseries. Now, I have a tendency to think there are fewer writers, unfortunately, than maybe there ought to be, that understand Thanos' voice. The guy, if you're looking for somebody that's done a great Thanos that wasn't Jim Starlin, obviously, in more recent years, kind of a hotshot, all-star, writer of today, Jeff Lemire did a Thanos series in the sort of 2016 thereabout. You'd find it pretty easily. Also really good. It's Thanos is sort of dying and like having to deal with that and going throughout the Marvel universe, sort of put it like squaring away his affairs in this way. But it's really good. So I recommend that as well. But okay. We did it, guys. Thank you so much. Thank you, listener, for listening. Hope you enjoyed the episode. Send us your thoughts on basically any platform, Twitter or in the comic section of any like of the platforms. And let us know what you think. What's your favorite Thanos story? What did you think of this story? Let us know. Give us a 5-star review on any platform, iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. Other ones.
Not Stitcher anymore.
Yeah, exactly. Okay.
Good night, everybody.
Thanks, everybody.
Thanks, bye.